Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia in for Mike Collins. Immigration policy has been a priority of President Donald Trump's second term. As the administration attempts to hit deportation goals, ICE agents have arrested people around courthouses, workplaces, and community gathering spots. This has caused fear in neighborhoods across the country, including here in Charlotte. And in recent weeks, protests against ICE detentions have come to a head, with people clashing with law enforcement over policies. In many ways, President Trump is making good on immigration promises he made during his campaign. But now that his plans are being enacted, how does the public view those policies in real time? And what are the short and long-term impacts on the communities being targeted for deportation? And how does that affect the region as a whole? This hour, we also look at how this could all impact the 2026 midterm elections and why Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina decided to not seek re-election next year. Are Republican lawmakers staying loyal to Trump, or is there a slow shift away? To help answer all these questions and more, my guests are WFAE race and equity reporter Julian Berger, Jason Husser, professor of political science and public policy and the director of the Elon Poll, and Chris Cooper, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University and the author of the book Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer. Thank you all for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
So we're going to start with the news that broke this week. On Tuesday, after days of debate, the Senate narrowly passed President Trump's giant tax and immigration bill. Vice President J.D. Vance cast the tie-breaking vote after a 50-50 tally, with three Republicans voting against the measure. One of those Republicans was Senator Tom Tillis, along with Susan Collins of Maine and Rand Paul of Kentucky. And there was some drama that came with his vote. Tillis announced Sunday he would not be seeking re-election. Chris, I'm going to start with you. What was your reaction to Tillis's decision not to run again?
Look, I was shocked. And frankly, I think people who say they weren't surprised, unless your name is Tom Tillis, I think you're probably telling us a fiction. I mean, this guy had given us every indication that he was going to run for office, right? So if you go through all the check marks, you say, okay, it's filed with the FEC. Well, not a big deal. He was already in office, but still that was done, collecting money. But then the big one, I thought, was the announcement, of course, that he was running, but then the announcement, his press release, that he was hiring a bunch of high-level staff. Some of those were folks he had hired before, people like Paul Shoemaker, who runs a lot of the high-profile campaigns in North Carolina. But I think really notably, he hired a number of Trump affiliated pollsters and kind of other staff members. And so that told me at the time, falsely, that Tom Tillis was really going to run for office again, that he was in it to win it, if you will. So when the news came down on Sunday, I was coming back from a mountain bike ride with my kids, and I thought, are people telling me lies over the phone? It just didn't make a lot of sense. But clearly, being sort of on point from Donald Trump's truth account was just probably one step too far for Tom Tillis. And he said, look, I'd like some freedom.
Jason, your reaction?
I was surprised as well, similar to Chris. I thought, is this true? And had to verify and double check till we saw the statement. And when I saw that statement, one thing stood out to me was Tillis talking about wanting to spend time with his two children, the quote, three beautiful grandchildren, rest of extended family. We often look at politicians as these rational actors who are hyper ambitious and always want to advance. But I think at the end of the day, they're still humans. And that conveyed in the press release to me.
Well, with all the effort it took to get Medicaid expansion passed in North Carolina, it sounds like that was one of the biggest reasons why Tillis didn't support Trump's bill, his concern about what it would do to North Carolinians on Medicaid. Tillis was quoted in a WUNC story saying, "So what do I tell the 663,000 people in 2 or 3 years when President Trump breaks his promise by pushing them off Medicaid because the funding is not there anymore?" The article goes on to say that he estimates overall North Carolina could lose $26 billion in healthcare funding. $26 billion. Does that figure sound correct to you, Chris?
It does sound correct to me. It also, you know, makes my sort of jaw drop at the same time. Mm. And look, I think this actually is consistent with Tom Tillis, right? So I've been spending a lot of time, like probably a lot of folks in the last few days going back and just kind of rereading old newspaper articles about Tom Tillis. Maybe that's just me. But anyway, from the time he got initially elected to the Cornelius Town Council, Town Commission, he was talking about fiscal responsibility, right? He's talking about school choice. He's talking about bread and butter, almost, if you will, George W. Bush conservative issues. And so it makes some sense to me that ultimately he would say, hey, you know, this price tag is too much. What this would do financially to the state that Tom Tillis feels like he helped build, right? Tom Tillis was called the architect of the takeover in 2010, where the Republicans took over the General Assembly in more than 100, well, in about 100 years. Then he was able to lead the House through some times of, I think he would call, fiscal responsibility. And I think he thinks and believes, and I think there's some evidence to suggest that he's right, that he did move the state forward in that way. So this is actually, I think, a pretty consistent view from Tom Tillis.
I know that you had an article come out in Politico, I believe yesterday afternoon, just talking about who Tillis was as a whole and his career as a politician. What do you think, from your point of view, losing a senator like Tillis, especially in a purple state like North Carolina, what does that mean for us heading into, 2026?
Yeah, I think it means a lot of different things. One, I think if we just consider just the raw power politics of it, right? We have somebody who was a power player in the Senate. I mean, somebody who in his second term had been able to be a rare voice that would sometimes every now and again cross over. No matter who we get, right, they're not going to have as much power. They're going to start as a freshman day one. I think that is significant and important. You can decide that's good or bad, but I think that matters. But I also think it suggests something about kind of legislative service. And I think Jason was talking about this really well, a few minutes ago, that Tom Tillis is talking about his grandkids. He's talking about his kids. We think about these people as being rational actors, but they're people with lives. If we also think about Patrick McHenry, right? So if you ask me, who are the two most powerful national political figures in North Carolina over the last, say, two decades, I'd probably say Tillis and McHenry. Both of them decided to step down, although for different reasons, but before they had to, right? Neither one was voted out of office. Neither one was too old. Heck, in this world, they're both like spring chickens for Congress, yet they both decided to step down and do something else. And so I think that says something to us about what these polarized political times and this modern politics means for just being in office, being in D.C., right? Dan Bishop also stepped down when he didn't have to. The list goes on and on and on. Being in Congress is not the gig that it used to be 20 years ago.
Jason, anything to add?
I think some of this is also North Carolina as a state has been wildly successful. There's booming economic opportunity in the state. Our tax base is strong to the extent that many of these people will have other opportunities back home in North Carolina.
Well, loyalty is something that comes up regularly in this administration. And I imagine Tillis knew, for lack of a better word, he was sort of a dead man walking when he, said that he was going to vote against Trump's bill. And according to a report in The Hill, there was a text exchange between Tillis and Trump before Tillis voted no, which I'm going to read. It said, "Ack, Mr. President, start thinking about my replacement." What are your reactions to that kind of exchange, Chris?
I mean, it's sort of pulling the curtain back, right? I mean, I think my first reaction is, wow, what we think is happening really is what's happening, right? This was the moment where Tom Tillis said, I've had enough, right? He had put out a release, it was probably about 2 months ago, talking about some of the violence and the threats of violence that had come against him. And at the time, I thought that was very important and, of course, a sad comment on our times, but I didn't know that that was part of a broader decision Tillis is making. I think with 2020 hindsight, you can see him saying, sending a little signal, saying, again, this is not such a great deal anymore. Then he goes toe-to-toe with Trump, and I think ultimately he just had enough. But yeah, I think the text exchange is fascinating, and it's fascinating, of course, to think through what other text exchanges are happening between United States senators and the president of the United States and on exactly what app are those occurring.
Yes, I think there are many of us that would love to read that book of just text exchanges. So let's turn to what we can expect from the candidate pool to look like for this run for Tillis's seat. I mean, what can we expect? We'll start with the Republicans. What names are being tossed around and what do we think that race will look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think Laura Trump is obviously a name that is being tossed around by everybody. And I think if she gets in, she is a field clearing candidate. In other words, Yeah, you might have one or two Republicans try to get in, but I think people will get the message. Laura Trump will get Donald Trump's endorsement. If she decides to enter, she's going to be the candidate. She's got till about September to make that decision, at least in terms of the paperwork of being a North Carolina resident, registered voter, Republican, all that kind of stuff. Other than Trump, the names that I'm hearing most often are Michael Whatley, of course, former head of the North Carolina Republican Party, moved then to co-chair of the RNC. I think Whatley is definitely a name that's being tossed around. Pat Harrigan, a freshman member of Congress, is another name that I think is being tossed around, you know, essentially in every list that I've seen. Greg Murphy is another one. Essentially, look, we have 10 Republican members of Congress right now. All of them except for Virginia Fox have had their names thrown around in at least one story as a potential replacement for Tom Tillis.
And let's turn to the Democrats. Who are we hearing about from that side?
I mean, I think Roy Cooper is the big name, right, that everybody's waiting for. There's the old play, Waiting for Godot. I feel like North Carolina's waiting for Roy Cooper to make a decision. If he gets in, he is a field-clearing candidate, much like Laura Trump. That might be the only time in history those two names have been mentioned together in the same sentence as being similar. But I think they are similar in their sort of ability to clear the field. But after that, Wiley Nickel is obviously already running, former member of Congress, former state senator. I've heard the name Rachel Hunt, the lieutenant governor, be tossed around. And then I think the stuff of fantasy for some Democrats would be Jeff Jackson.
Well, politics feels more polarized now more than ever. Do you think candidates will have to move further left or right in order to get elected in the primary and have more concessions and moderation to get a win in the general? Or is it the opposite? Jason.
We've seen this really trend among North Carolina Republicans, at least, that these high-level races have picked candidates to the right of the party itself. So Mark Robinson was really flailing before the scandals broke. And largely that had to do with he was ideologically positioned where he wasn't really consistent with his own party on a number of issues. One could argue Dan Forrest in the 2020 cycle had a similar issue. So it is both a primary issue in terms of trying to meet the median voter of the Republican side or the Democratic side. But I think there's also sort of dynamics within the party system itself that more electable candidates have had a hard time getting through the Republican Party process. What I'm not sure of is, has this sort of what I would call a Mark Robinson fiasco for Republicans in 2024 led them to do the types of sort of soul searching and changes needed to try to pick a more electable candidate?
We're coming up to a break, but I want to ask one last question. We are a year and a half out of this race, so a lot can happen in that time. But do you all think that there will be a Senate race watched more closely than this one? Chris, I'll start with you.
In a word, no. I mean, I think this is going to be the most watched Senate race in the country. You can make an argument for Georgia, but I think at the end of the day, especially if we end up with Cooper versus Trump, I mean, can you imagine a better reality TV show than that one? I think it's going to have every eye on North Carolina.
Jason.
If we have this Cooper versus Trump, it will, I think, be the marquee race of the country. Cooper's a fairly known commodity. If there's any sort of thing about him that hasn't gotten out yet, it would be shocking that there'd be something new after as long as he's been in North Carolina politics. But Laura Trump is still in many ways an unknown and will be sort of riding forward based upon family ties and family name.
Well, when we come back, we're going to dive into how Trump's immigration policies are impacting North Carolinians on a local level. I'm speaking with WFAE's Julian Berger, Jason Husser with Elon University, and Chris Cooper from Western Carolina University. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia, in for Mike Collins. We're discussing immigration policies, which have been at the center of President Trump's priorities in his second term, and we're breaking down the politics of these policies, whether support is waning, and how they're impacting the economy in North Carolina. My guests today are WFAE's race and equity reporter, Julian Berger, Jason Husser, professor of political science and public policy and the director of the Elon Poll, and Chris Cooper, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University and the author of the book Anatomy of a Purple State. Before we dive into a local level of these immigration policies and their impact, Jason, I wanted to ask you, what does polling suggest when it comes to public support for Trump's immigration policies, and how have we seen that change over time?
At the Elon University poll, we've been asking about immigration in North Carolina for quite a while now. Some of our big questions include, which of these statements come closest to your own view, even if neither is right? We asked people, are you closer that immigrants are a benefit to North Carolina or immigrants are a burden to North Carolina? We found back in March 2025 is 51% said immigrants are a benefit to the state, 31% said they were a burden, 18% said they were unsure. What's interesting to me is this largely tracks what I found when I asked this question back in 2013. Back in 2013, 51% again said immigrants were more of a benefit, 38% said more of a burden. So we've seen a slight decrease in the sort of benefit or burden. We have seen, though, a slight decline, depending on how you define slight, on support for a pathway to citizenship. In 2025, we found a majority still support a pathway to citizenship of 60%+. But that was at 80% back in 2013. So it does seem that there's been a hardening about some attitudes during the Trump administration. I mean, interestingly, if we look at Gallup and other national sources, Democrats have in some ways moved more toward supporting immigration while Republicans have hardened against it. That said, immigration attitudes are remarkably stable when we take measurements of the same people across periods of time.
Julian, you're speaking directly to members of the immigrant communities here in Charlotte who are being impacted. I imagine there's a lot of fear and anxiety in these communities. Can you share what you're hearing from folks who are living in this everyday fear of their status and ICE presence? Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I think, like you mentioned, there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of anxiety. There's plenty of people that, compared to the last administration, they're more in hiding now. A lot of people are very wary about going to the grocery store, going to drop their kids off at school, going to their workplace, because there's been examples of ICE presence at all of those places recently. Even, you know, those that are undocumented are facing the brunt of it, but even those that have papers are also living in fear as well, especially those that are naturalized citizens who are worried that Trump may one day denaturalize their citizenship. So we're seeing it on all fronts of the immigrant community, those with papers, those without papers.
And this is hitting Charlotte in particular. Julian, you reported on a man who was recently arrested in East Charlotte after living here for decades, working as a sheetrocker. His family said he did not have a criminal record. Tell us about that story and where he is now, what his future is looking like.
Yeah, so I spoke to this man. He has lived in Charlotte for over 30 years, from Mexico, undocumented. He was detained off of Central Avenue in East Charlotte in May. And so this was during the larger ICE presence that ICE had in Charlotte for about two to three weeks back in May. And when he was arrested, he was detained by ICE. I had contacted his daughter trying to figure out more about who he was, what he did. He was a construction worker. He was a sheetrocker. And his daughter was like, he wasn't a criminal. He never did anything bad in this country. And when I went through, you know, court legal documents, he didn't have any criminal record at all. The only thing I found was he drove without a license back in 2008. That was the only thing I could find on him. So, you know, that's just one example of how ICE is not just targeting those who are criminals, but those who are here undocumented and aren't doing anything here.
And do we know what his status is? If he's still detained, if he's been deported, or?
Yeah, so he was released on bond a couple weeks ago. And now his family is trying to figure out how to get everything together to try to get him legal status. So they're getting all his documents together and trying to fight his case. That way he isn't removed back to Mexico.
Well, then there was the ICE raid in Kings Mountain last week where federal agents arrested 30 people at a factory there. I believe it was on Wednesday during a workplace enforcement operation led by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. At the time of that arrest, of those arrests, there was a lot of unknowns. What have we learned in almost the week that's gone by since those arrests, where those folks are now and what they can expect?
Yeah, so like you said, 30 undocumented workers were arrested last week in that manufacturing plant in Kings Mountain. We don't know much more. that's something that we've always struggled with ICE on. They're very hesitant to give us more information. But we do know that this was a joint operation with ICE, Homeland Security Investigations, also the Kings Mountain Police Department, Gastonia Police Department, as well as the Gaston County Sheriff's Department. So it was a huge operation and it lasted hours on end. ICE did release photos and videos of kind of what took place. And we don't know where they're at now, the people that were arrested, because they haven't released any names or countries of origin. But my assumption is that they were transferred to Stewart Detention Center, which is in Georgia. And that's typically where whoever is detained by ICE in this area, that's where they're typically sent to.
Okay, well, you answered my next question was, where are these folks headed after they are detained in Charlotte? They're going to Stewart, Georgia. Are they then flown out of the country or are they driven out of the country? How is that working?
Yeah, so once somebody who's detained is in Stewart in Georgia, they'll have a removal proceeding. So it depends on, it typically takes weeks, maybe like a month or two to get that removal proceeding. And then that's when a judge will decide whether you're ordered for removal or if you're eligible to stay in the U.S. So that's people that are in Stewart, that's kind of what they're waiting on, that removal proceeding to then decide if they're flown out of the country.
And when we look at what happened in Kings Mountain, where there were 30 arrests, how does that compare to other ones like the one in East Charlotte, where one person is arrested and detained? Who's typically in charge of these mass raids like in Kings Mountain versus one person being arrested on Central Avenue in Charlotte?
Yeah, so typically the Department of Homeland Security and ICE, they have different branches. So for the Kings Mountain one, Homeland Security Investigations, that's kind of the branch that focuses on larger scale raids. And it typically has to do with criminal raids, drug operations as well. They're the ones that kind of enforce those larger scale raids. But then you have, you know, the one or two people that are detained in East Charlotte, though, that's typically regular ICE agents that are in unmarked cars, and that in this case they pulled over that construction van and they arrested that man.
According to an NBC deportation tracker, and this is based on data current through June 20th, 55,764 people have been deported, and about 28% of those folks with criminal convictions, 25% with pending criminal charges, and about 47% listed as other immigration violators. So on a local level, how hard is it to constantly be keeping up with the latest coming from ICE and these deportation numbers? How do you communicate with them? Are they responsive, or are you more relying on national outlets like NBC to kind of help paint this picture?
Yeah, so it's you're exactly right. It's relying on NBC, on outlets like New York Times that are getting these national numbers, and that's mainly the only numbers we have. I've been trying for the longest since January, since Trump came into office, to get numbers on the Charlotte area, on North Carolina as a whole. And that's been something that ICE is not willing to provide. I've been struggling to get that information. And, you know, I go into it asking, hey, I don't need, you know, the names or, you know, anything that's going to give away identity. I just want numbers of how many arrests, how many people you're arresting citywide, countywide, statewide. And that's something that they're reluctant to give to me. And it is hard. Recently, I've emailed them, I've called them. They are not likely to answer my calls, likely to respond. And that's been since they had that larger ICE operation back in May. Since then, they've been reluctant to respond to me.
Chris, do we have a sense yet of what impact these deportations are having on North Carolina's electoral makeup for voters?
It's a great question. I don't think we do have a very good sense, right, of that. I mean, we have a sense of people that identify by certain races, obviously, in the voter registration pool and their propensity to vote or not to vote. But I think there's a couple of boring but important reasons why it's hard to answer that very good question, right? One is we don't have a definitive list to be able to cross-check and see how many of these people were actually registered to vote. And everything we know about race in terms of registered voters in the state of North Carolina is based on self-identification, right? So you go to register to vote and you say, my name is Chris Cooper, and this is how I identify in terms of race and ethnicity. We've seen an increasing number of people who are not filling out that part of voter registration. This is something our friend Michael Bitzer and I have looked into a good bit, and I think it's creating a real problem for tracking exactly what the effects of all sorts of political phenomena are on people of different races, ethnicities, and even genders.
Jason.
Back in February, we wanted to know what were people thinking once the sensitive location guidance was being rescinded about state and local law enforcement working with ICE. So we asked people, should state, county, local law enforcement assist federal immigration and customs enforcement in enforcing immigration laws in churches, schools, and hospitals? And one thing we found with that was generally more mixed reaction about state and local law enforcement than you'd find for immigration overall. So we found only 40% said yes, local law enforcement should work with ICE. 41% were no, 19% were unsure. And that sort of comes down to another pattern we found in which we're finding more people may, in abstract or in theory, support deportations. But then when we're asking them about their specific local level, we're seeing opposition or at least concerns go up. So we asked people, for instance, if they knew someone who was in the country illegally, and then asking if they thought that person should be deported. And what we found with that was that more people were going to say no to the person that they know personally than they would have an abstract about deportation policy in general.
North Carolina's foreign-born population has increased eightfold since 1990. It went from 2% of the population to nearly 10% of the population. As these folks are deported, what impact, Julian, does this have on the economy of North Carolina?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing now that we've been seeing is, like I mentioned earlier in the show, that ICE raids are causing the immigrant community to live in fear, to live that they can't be out and about like they once did before. So in turn, we're seeing that our local economy here in Charlotte is suffering because of that. I spoke to a number of businesses here in Charlotte that they're seeing their revenues go down because immigrants are less likely to go into their business to shop, to buy goods, groceries, all of that. So we're seeing that because these ICE raids are taking place, people are living in fear. They're not going out to the stores. They're not going to concerts, to FIFA matches, to things like that. So we're seeing that the economy is suffering.
Yeah, and one report that you had recently was an interview with an East Charlotte bakery, and the owner of the bakery, this really stuck with me, said that he was what he was experienced with his business right now was worse than what he experienced during COVID and the shutdown.
During Manolo Bethancourt, he told me he was like, I'm having to lay off workers. He went at the time that I spoke with him, which was last month, he was like, I've already laid off three of my employees because I'm not able to pay them as much as I want to. And Manolo is an example of a naturalized citizen who is also living in fear. Just this week, he posted a video on his Facebook of him having to carry around with his passport because he has that fear of, I'm Latino, I don't want to be stopped by ICE and not be able to, prove to them that I'm a citizen.
North Carolina Governor Josh Stein vetoed two immigration bills, and so far there hasn't been an override. Julian, I want to break down these two bills for folks. There's first SB 153, the North Carolina Border Protection Act. What does that bill do? Can you break down what that would do if it was passed?
Yeah, so House Bill 153, what it does is, or Senate Bill 153, sorry, what it does is it now would require state law enforcement to cooperate with ICE. So that's the Department of Public Safety, the Highway Patrol, the Department of Adult Corrections, those types of statewide departments. They would now have to cooperate with ICE. Another part of the bill is ensuring that state-funded benefits like Medicaid, food stamps, all of that, that undocumented people cannot obtain those benefits. Another part of that as well is to ensure that all UNC schools in the state of North Carolina, that they cannot act as sanctuary campuses for undocumented students. So it's a multi-pronged bill that focuses on different parts to fight back against undocumented immigrants and ensure more cooperation with ICE.
Yeah, we've heard of sanctuary cities. What is a sanctuary campus?
Yeah, so a sanctuary campus would basically be a school that allows a student to, an undocumented student, to stay on campus and to prohibit ICE from coming onto the campus to detain them.
There's also House Bill 318, the Criminal Illegal Alien Enforcement Act. Break down that one for us.
Yeah, so House Bill 318 is an extension of House Bill 10, which was passed in the last session of the North Carolina General Assembly. So what that does is, in both now, as it states in House Bill 10, sheriffs in North Carolina, they have to notify ICE that an undocumented immigrant is in their jail, and they have to do that. They have 48 hours to notify ICE. They have to leave that inmate in jail for 48 hours, and then they could be released. So now what that does, what House Bill 318 does, is it makes sure that sheriffs give another notification to ICE 2 hours before they're supposed to release the inmate. So you have that 48-hour hold, and then now you also have that 2-hour notification. So it's basically an extra step to make sure that ICE knows that an inmate is in their jail.
And as a reminder, Republicans currently control a supermajority in the Senate, but there's one seat short in the House, which means they need at least one Democrat to join them in voting to break a veto. They could also use absences among Democrats, which could lower the threshold the GOP needs to meet an override for a veto. We're going to discuss this a little bit further and keep the conversation going after a quick break. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia. We're discussing the Trump administration's immigration policies and how those policies impact North Carolinians. My guests this hour include WFAE's race and equity reporter, Julian Berger, Jason Husser, professor of political science and public policy and director of the Elon Poll, and Chris Cooper, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University and author of the book Anatomy of a Purple State. Before the break, Julian, we were talking about two bills that Governor Stein recently vetoed, SB 153 and HB 318. What are we hearing about the possibility of either of those bills, those vetoes, being overridden?
Yeah, that's something that we're looking at deeply because we really don't know. So the Senate still, the Republicans in the Senate, they still have a supermajority, but in the House, there isn't a supermajority, so it would only take one Democrat in the House to side with Republicans to override Stein's veto for either one of those bills. So immigrant advocates here in North Carolina, they've been looking at Representative Carla Cunningham, and she's one that she voted for House Bill 318. She was the only Democrat to vote with Republicans for it. And so we're looking to see if she will side with them again to override Stein's veto on this bill.
Have you spoken with her since that vote?
I have not. So I spoke with her right after that vote. Mm-hmm. But once Stein vetoed the bill, I have been trying to get in contact with her and she has not responded.
All right. Well, we look forward to hearing her response when you get a hold of her. Chris, I'm going to switch back to you and go back in time. In 2024, there was a WRAL story in which you noted that immigration was looking like the winning issue for Republicans in the 2024 election. Even Democrats and independents were polled and wanted to see the southern border reduced or shut down. So my first question is, were you right? And then I want to follow up with Jason.
Yeah, I mean, I think to some degree, I was right in that that Americans in general tended to trust Republicans more than Democrats on immigration, right? So I think we can get into what exactly has happened since then, as I'm sure Jason will, and whether what was promised is what's been delivered or whether it's been perhaps over-delivered. But at the time, yes, I think that public opinion was more on the side of Republicans than Democrats. It was a winning issue for the Republican Party. And I think that is one of a few reasons why Donald Trump ultimately not only took the White House, but won all the swing states, as he is quick to say.
Jason.
My data is a bit old, and the context of that is it's like 9 months old, and we are in a world in which, you know, 6 months change makes a huge difference. But if we just look at the most recent data that Elon Poll, Gallup, other organizations have collected, it still does look like immigration attitudes have largely been something Republicans have benefited more from. If we look at Gallup tracking data from 1965 to now, asking should immigration be kept at its present level, increased or decreased, back in June 24, Gallup found only 16% said increased. That's down from 34% in May 2020. On the other hand, on the decreased area, we're seeing now 55% of Americans overall saying immigration should be decreased compared to 28% back in 2020. So there does seem to be some contextual movement towards sort of anti-immigration attitudes. But it's important to note that other research has found that Trump's rhetoric and the Trump policies haven't necessarily persuaded people that much as much as activated pre-existing attitudes. And so it's more that they've raised certain things to salience that were already sort of leaning towards the Republican side, rather than leading to sort of this massive shift towards the Republican Party because of immigration. We also found, when it comes to this question about what impact it might have on the local economy, some evidence, though, that these local economic and sort of human impacts that Julian was talking about earlier could turn some independents away from Republicans. What we found back in early spring 2025 was for every two people who thought that it was going to be a positive local economic impact for deportation, there were three who thought local impact would be negative once we look among independents. So for every two people who thought this was going to be a good thing on their local economy, three thought it was going to be a bad thing when we come to sort of swing voters in North Carolina. As more stories come out, as more people talk about, well, I can't get anybody to work here, or we haven't seen customers coming into business, that could lead sort of a few voters tipping away from Republicans. But there's always a potential that there's going to be some bigger overriding issue of the economy overall, what interest rates are doing, wars in the Middle East that really take people's mind off of immigration when it comes to the midterm elections.
Yeah. And getting ready for the show, we had a conversation about if there were, you know, Republicans who were Trump supporters because of his stance on the economy, felt like he was going to make good decisions there and maybe were less concerned about social issues or immigration policies. And now that the economy is suffering, you know, if their ideology is perhaps shifting a little bit and if they could then become maybe a little bit more concerned about other issues like immigration, is there data that supports that?
I don't have direct data on that, but one thing that is always on my mind is that presidents can be over-rewarded or over-punished in part because of things unrelated to what they're doing. Mm. So we're seeing sort of rapid technological proliferation right now, which has led to economic growth in certain areas. If you invested money in some of these tech stocks that have been AI dependent, you may have suffered, your local economy may have suffered a great deal, but your IRA could look great in having nothing to do with anything Trump did whatsoever.
Chris, I see you nodding your head along.
No, I was just, as usual, I'm finding myself in agreement with Jason. And it's just, it's interesting to think about, you know, we talk about the economy as if it is this one thing, right? That it is either good or it's bad, it's up or it's down. And I think as Jason illustrated so well right there, the state of the economy is in the eye of the beholder. And even the same beholder may see the economy very differently depending on whether they're looking at their IRA or some other indicator. So I just think, you know, sometimes we boil the economy down to the old Bill Clinton, James Carville line, right? It's the economy stupid, but really it's the economy's stupid, right? It's really about the ways in which we perceive the economy as this kind of multi-headed beast, not just one thing.
I want to go back to a poll that you mentioned earlier in the program, Jason. I believe it was a February 2025 Elon poll that came out roughly a month into Trump's second term. So the poll found that 53% of Americans supported mass deportations. That includes 89% of Republicans and 60% of older Americans. Also, 57% of Democrats and 42% of Black Americans were those opposed to mass deportations. To the best of our knowledge, is that data from February still accurate? Or as we've seen deportations play out on the news and the fear and the anxiety in the immigrant community, we hear more of those voices. Has there been a shift?
We are likely to repeat many of these immigration questions later in the fall as more and more people have experienced what impact these ICE raids and other things have done in the state. But generally, other research has found that if you take surveys that are not set up to be so much cross sections trying to measure a snapshot of the country as a whole, but track change in specific individuals over time, so you call the same people back and you do that over multiple years, is that immigration attitudes are really stable. They're stable along the lines of party ID and other factors. So my guess is if we are seeing changes from what we found back in February, it's largely at the margin, so 3 or 4% sort of change one way or another. Back in February, we did find the people could hold somewhat conflicting views on immigration, so they might support mass deportation, but they also might worry that it was going to cause economic problems. It could cause other things like labor shortages. They might even see that it might not impact crime like Trump had touted in some of his speeches, but they still support it. So we found a similar thing with Trump's policies around tariffs. It's a bit confusing to me as a pollster, is that people could be supportive of tariffs, but also think, yeah, they're sort of bad overall. I think we are in an era which some people, and enough to detect, are supportive of Trump to the extent that they may not actually like the entire policy package or all elements of it, but they can get behind it as a whole. We're seeing that reflected in the big, beautiful bill discussions right now.
Jason, can you pull back the curtain a little bit on how Elon does its polling? I mean, we're talking about this February poll from this year. When you go back and re-poll folks to see how the data has or hasn't changed, tell us a little bit about that process. Are you going back to the same people, and how do you reach out to them?
We have done quite a few different methodological approaches over the years. At one point, all of our interviews were done in a call center slash classroom that was right outside my office, and I was physically present for every phone number that we dialed. We've changed because people don't answer their phones anymore. And so at the current moment, and these polls I've been referencing, were done by a third-party data provider, YouGov, a large survey company that recruits people from a variety of means across the country and then conducts these surveys online. We're not doing what's called panel surveys very often. We have done them in the past, in which you call the same people back and forth. But I'm currently exploring ways to try to get at an issue that Chris mentioned earlier, which is we don't really know what the voter file means as much anymore. And so I'm going back to reaching out to people directly from the voter registration list.
And how big is that polling sample? I mean, how many folks are you trying to reach before you, you know, analyze this data?
We typically try to reach about 1,000 North Carolinians, though really after you talk to about 300, results don't change that much.
According to data from The Witness at the Border, which advocates for U.S.-based migrants, there have been more than 350 deportation flights since the start of the year. And according to ICE, the average cost of a charter flight is nearly $9,000. A, quote, special high-risk charter flight can cost as high as $27,000. Julian, I know we were talking a little bit before the show about how much it costs to deport someone and, you know, how much the American people are eating that cost. So what does the data say about how much it costs to deport someone?
Yeah, so to deport one singular person, the Department of Homeland Security is saying it costs around $17,000, and that includes the cost of arresting them, detaining them, and then removing them. And like I said, somebody may be detained in a detention center for weeks, months at a time, so that cost includes that period of time as well.
But as far as how much it's costing taxpayers, I mean, is there any way, Chris, that we could ever figure that figure out?
You know, maybe there's some way. You know, Jason right now is probably trying to come up with a research design to get us there, but it's extremely difficult, right? Because yes, we can say what the average cost is, but I think as Julian's talked about really well with all these different examples, the average may not really mean the normal, right? We may have folks where it is extremely inexpensive, as horrible as it sounds to sort of quantify these sort of deportations. If somebody is detained right by the border and sent back fairly quickly, that's obviously going to be a very different cost than somebody who is sent from Michigan to this new detention facility in the Everglades that we're just now trying to understand that cost, what, $450 million, and they're held there for a while and then they're sent somewhere else. So we can come up with an average cost. I'm just not sure how meaningful the average is in this case.
Julian.
Yeah, and I think another thing to think about statewide here in North Carolina is as House Bill 318 comes into effect and as House Bill 10 went into law, sheriffs are now having to pay the bill of holding these undocumented immigrants in their jails for that extra 48 hours. Sheriff McFadden here in Mecklenburg County, he said it costs close to $200 a night per undocumented inmate that they're having to hold them. So that's another extra added cost that taxpayers at the end of the day are having to pay for.
I want to bring up one more Elon poll before we leave for the hour. It's from March 2025. And Jason, I know you mentioned it earlier, but I want to dig in a little bit deeper. It suggests that immigration is an issue that is still split between party lines. The Elon poll finds that North Carolinians are opposed to major federal agency cuts. But Elon saw a 17% decrease in support of a program that would create a pathway to citizenship. Compare that to 2013, when North Carolinians supported that path at 80%. I know that's more than a decade of time that has passed, but wow, going from an 80% support to a pathway to citizenship to that being decreased to 17%. I mean, what's going on there?
Some ways, what we found was that support has fallen, but opposition has not really increased. So in 2025, we found 19% of North Carolinians opposed a pathway to citizenship program, which includes certain requirements such as background checks and paying any fines or taxes. In 2013, we found 17% opposed that. What's changed, and some of this is probably an artifact of survey error, is the no opinion, sort of don't knows, people on the fence have changed. So it's not so much that people have flipped from support to a pathway to opposition. It's that a portion of the people who supported it have moved to the I'm not sure so much anymore camp.
Chris, anything to add?
No, I think it's just been it, sort of like we're talking about the economy before, right? Where there is not just one economy. I think when we try to parse immigration policy, I think one thing this discussion highlights is that people may hold these pretty complicated opinions that may sometimes seem to run counter to themselves, right? They may think that they want one thing in one example, but when it's prompted that it is coming from a singular politician like Donald Trump, their opinions may shift.
Finally, we have two political scientists on this panel, so I wanted to leave with asking you both. There is so much news going on right now. There is so much going on out of Washington and how it impacts us on a local level. How do you, when you talk to students about staying informed, when you talk to folks about, making sure that they have the facts and not getting overwhelmed by the news, Chris, what do you say to your students to make sure that they can be good news consumers, and not get lost in the shuffle of everything that's coming out of Washington?
Yeah, I love that question, right? I mean, we all have a volume problem, right? The volume is just too high. And so what do you do to try to bring the volume down and to try to just get the important information and understand how politics affects you and how you can affect politics better? I mean, the first suggestion I have for students is obvious, which they may not listen to, but turn off the social media feed. You know, too often I think our students are getting their news from social media, which doesn't seem to be bad unless it finds out that it was from 2 years ago when they happened to retweet it.
We're going to have to leave it there. That's all the time we have this morning. I want to thank my guests, WFAE's Julian Berger, Elon University's Jason Husser, and Western Carolina's Chris Cooper. I'm Sarah D'Elia, filling in for Mike Collins. Thanks so much for listening this morning. This has been Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.